We use it right now to create most of our application, which we use every day. But it was not created to do this. It was created to create, you know, a scientific paper, which you like share between your colleagues in university. And it shows that frontend is wild. It was not created, you know, like by some idea, by some plan. It was created by, you know, the spirit of evolution, which, you know, changes the way every time something goes to another way. And so I like this spirit of frontend architecture.
Hey, before we get started, I'd like to remind you the full version of this episode is only available to our paid subscribers. The current platforms you can subscribe on are YouTube, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and Patreon. In the full version of this episode, we delve a little bit deeper into Entree's CRDT tool, Logix, and of course, you get to hear all of our tool tips. With that, let's get on to the episode. Hello, welcome to the DevTools FM podcast. This is a podcast about developer tools and the people who make them. I'm Andrew, and this is my co-host, Justin.
Hey, everyone. I'm really, really excited for our guest today. We have Andre Sitnik on. Andre works as an engineer at Evil Martians, which if you go back to episode 56, we did an episode with them. And you're such just a huge force in open source, so it's incredibly exciting to have you on. You've done tools like AutoPrefixer, PostCSS, Browsers List. I mean, it's a long list. So tremendous, tremendous honor for us to have you on. But before we get started, would you like to tell our guests a little bit more about yourself?
Thanks for a nice introduction. Yep. So as you mentioned, I created a few tools which work with CSS, also with CRDT. And right now, my main point of interest is OKLCH, because I really like how it works with the colors, not because it's like a huge topic, but since it's a nice way. Right now, I live in Barcelona, and like, yep, I'm working in Evil Martians.
That's so cool. So it's really hard to state like how big of an impact that you've had, especially in the web space and open source tooling. How did you get started just like doing open source stuff? Did that come out of Evil Martians, or was that just something you started before?
No, I started as a developer, as an open source developer. It was, you know, inside my like a way of living. Like it was one of the reasons why I came to software development, not because it has a lot of big salaries. It was, you know, late 90s, beginning of 2000, which in Russia we don't have a lot of money. But it was a magazine called The Hacker. It was a magazine about, you know, hacker culture, not, you know, a criminal culture like in computer industry, but about the culture of, you know, using a tech to embrace yourself, like similar to DEF CON. Like if you want to have the spirit, go to DEF CON conference, like the best one. And as a result, like, the spirit that we should own our systems, that we should now own our data, is become part of my personality. And it results that like I started as being internet in as a administrator in Wikipedia. So open source not only about the code, it's also about the knowledge and many other things. And so like open source was the way how I go to the commercial programming, not opposite way.
So did you go to school for computer science, or did you just get into it outside of school?
There was none of the school in Russia at that moment. There was only schools, you know, about the algorithm and, you know, all this, you know, university, computer science, rocket science stuff. I just read a specification, like TCP specification, CSS specification that translation to Russian.
That's an interesting path, because it seems, especially for, there's a lot of people when they're getting started, like reading a specification, for example, can be a kind of a dense thing to sort of like wrap your head around. So yeah. that's definitely, you had a pretty high learning curve there, I'm sure.
Yep, absolutely.
Do you remember the first open source tool you got started in? Because that sounds like that was a pretty long time ago at this point. You're reading TCP specs. Yeah.
It was the tool for education through the internet. Like, as we have everything right now, it was like a project like this. But it was, you know, a school project, But it was on open source. I had an account in SourceForge. It was like a GitHub, but in the 90s. So like I had a few projects there. Like also it was, you know, we could call it like Next.js, but you know, in the 80s, like when you like don't have like a, it was a fast CGI system, which like serve static HTML without runtime things. Like, you know, it was a small and shitty project.
Fast CGI used to be all the rage. That's cool. So let's talk about some of the like more recent, maybe more well-known projects that you've worked on. So there's a whole birth of them. One that would be really interesting to talk about is Browsers List. This has been a very important tool in the like polyfilling space or transpilation space. Could you sort of explain what it is and what the motivation for creating it was?
This project is not maybe a library, but of course this is a library, but the idea is that this is a config. So this is like a convention that we have a single place to describe our target browsers. So the browsers which we support as a project. The like initial, it grew from the autoprefixer. So like in Russia, we had a very popular browser called Opera. It was technically Norwegian, but was very popular in Russia, much more popular than Internet Explorer or like other tools. And I felt at that moment that all developers, they're creating a website for the American browsers, and nobody cares about Opera, but like it's very popular in some other countries. And we faced this like unfair condition. And as a result, when I developed Autoprefixer, I thought that if I will give users options to select just a version of each browser, Edge, Chrome, Firefox, people in United States will think only about the browsers popular in United States, and this like unfair condition will continue. As a result, I thought about a way to describe a policy of the browsers which we support rather than the versions. So for instance, like last two versions or like more than 1% of popularity in my country or like in my statistic of my site or like browsers which support ES modules, for instance. And this is a config. It's a config with a special like high-level queries where you can describe your policies about the browsers. It was created to be like ported to any languages. For instance, we have a port to Rust. But right now, the like JavaScript library is the main way to use it. And so it used by Autoprefixer, by Babel presentenv, by PostCSS presentenv, and many linters and small tools, or also by like Lightning CSS and other tools.
Yeah, it's really become like a de facto standard. I probably wouldn't have said that maybe like 5 years ago, but like now it's like every single tool supports browser list out of the box.
I hope so, because it will make our world much better place.
Yeah. I find it really interesting that it was created to support Opera of all browsers. Like if you would have asked me what browser it was to support, I would have guessed like Firefox or like maybe Safari, but that's cool that it was Opera.
At that moment, Firefox was very big market. Unfortunately, not right now, but like I really hope that it will grow its market place.
So do you think that like years ago, support for the various CSS properties was very like fragmented. There were many like browser specific attributes that you had to have. But as time's gone on, things have really consolidated into like one set of rules and nothing like is prefixed at all anymore. So do you think going forward, a tool like Browser List will become less useful, or will we kind of always need it around there to help us fill the gaps between the future and what we currently have?
I think that we always will need a browser list or some similar tool, because it's not only about the vendor prefixes in CSS, for instance, or like even the polyfills. We always will need a polyfill. This is like how people will work. But we also need a single place for a new developer coming to our projects to go and to check what browsers do we support. So this is not only for tools, it's also for the people, like a single place.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. We talk about this a lot when we talk about like type systems, right? It's like the type system is for correctness sake, but it's also sort of like developer documentation sort of. So this is an interesting thing because I've, you know, had a lot of jobs in the past where it's like we had this question. It's like, well, what browsers do we support? And having this configuration to say, like, this is specifically the browsers we're targeting is a, yeah, it is. It is very valuable as a sort of like documentation too.
Yeah. But Andrew raised a very interesting question about the vendor prefixes in CSS. The funny part, when I just created autoprefixer, like just a week before, the Chrome announced that they will not add any prefixes in the Blink engine. And you know, like I creating a tool, like autoprefixer is a tool which adds a vendor prefixes to CSS. And like creating a tool which already dead. Like it will be not like useless. It will be useless in just a few years. And as a funny part, this is a project which like I hope it will die. I don't want to support it. I don't, like, we should be in the place when we don't need such tool. But unfortunately, I still can't remove it from my production projects because we still have a few small properties which nobody remember. And every time they create a problems for users, especially, you know, for browsers like Samsung or like UC browsers, very popular in Asia region. So as a result, we unfortunately still need autoprefixer, but I agree that like at some point it should be dead.
That's fun to hear that you want your own tool to die.
Yep.
Before we move on to other tools, did autoprefixer or browsers list come first? Or did you guys have like the foresight to go, oh, these are two separate tools and let's build them separately?
Initially, it was, I think, rework prefixes. So like it was a post-CSS like tool, which called Rework. It was an idea from TJ Hlavachuk. And so it was only a plugin for Rework. But I very quickly found that like Rework does not solve all problems, which we need as a like basement for autoprefixer development. And I started autoprefixer as a tool. And then I understood like it was during my conversations with Compass team. So they have the same prefixes feature. And so they like, I found that why we have config only for autoprefixer, why not also for the Compass? It was a project for SaaS world. And as a result, it was created, like I just split this code from autoprefixer just to be, so this code will be used by any other front-end tool.
Yeah, so Compass was a Ruby, it was like in the Ruby ecosystem, right? Yeah. Nice.
Yeah. This is old.
Cool. So, let's talk a little bit about PostCSS. PostCSS is another one of those tools that's been hugely, hugely influential in the ecosystem. So, I think about, we were talking about Compass and SAS. I mean, I think about like, you know, in the 2010s, it's like mostly using like Less and SAS and stuff like that. That was like primary usage. And now, pretty much every project that I use uses like PostCSS almost exclusively for a lot of the transformations. So let's talk a little bit about the origins of PostCSS. Like what was your original goal for the project?
Yeah, but like one small note, even if you don't use PostCSS, like obviously, if you don't know that you're using, you very likely use it anyway, because like if you use Webpack, it's already PostCSS, so like it's mostly another project. So initially it was only a framework to create a tool like autoprefixer. So initially it should not be like end users, developers should not like know about PostCSS, they should know about styling, autoprefixer, Webpack, so it should be hidden. But I very quickly found that people are afraid to add a new CSS processing tool to their project. And so initial idea was, so I need a fork of Rework to do like much more complex stuff as a basement for autoprefixer. But also it has some philosophy. I want to have a world when we as a community control CSS. Like right now, it's like there is a CSS working group and they do stuff. The browser do stuff. But we as a developer have no way to like, I don't know, test a new feature or like, you know, suggest a new idea. We have it, but you know, it's not in how people think about the CSS. And so I want to like encourage people to think about CSS as the tool that they own. And so encourage them to create a many processing tool around CSS. So like, you know, be creative, be fun around CSS. Or for instance, like create a polyfills before we will implement this feature in browser, so we will be able to test it and, you know, fix some issues, some problems, developing experience problems before it was, you know, frozen to the browser implementation. Like, we can't change browser implementation because we can break the web. So as a result, it was, you know, I found that many people, they're afraid to add a new CSS tool to their projects because, you know, it's something new, I don't want it, you know, it's very afraid, I will not be able to convince my colleagues. And so this is why we put a post CSS in the first place. So like an end user tool, because we like want to encourage people that, you know, you don't add a new tool, you just add a new plugin to your existing tool. So don't be afraid, you know, go crazy, do some, you know, crazy stuff with your CSS. Like, start to write SVG directly in your CSS, and then we will write a CSS specification, which like will allow it like officially. And so like, this is the story of PostCSS. So PostCSS is a framework if like for people who want to do some automated work with CSS. Find some issues, change one syntax to another, or like, you know, do some boring stuff like inlining images.
Yeah, it's cool that you guys had that realization, because like, definitely at the time, like, there was a bunch of tools that all did kind of the same thing but didn't really plug together. And then to go like, no, we're going to create one tool that kind of goes across the board and you can plug all these different things into. Yeah, I can just like, there's no way I would add like a whole new tool to be like, oh, let's try out some CSS variables before they exist. But adding a plugin, no brainer.
Yep.
It's really interesting because I feel like this is a lot of the stories that the transpilers go through, right? So it's like they start off as like solving a very official problem, like, you know, 6 to 5 before it was Babel was just like, really, this is like, we want to compile this, you know, ES6 down to ES5 or whatever, make it like more compatible. And then it turned into, you know, what Babel is today, more of a like rich plugin ecosystem where you can sort of, you can leverage all these things, but you can also do what you want. And then it seems like PostCSS goes through that very, very similar story. And I think, you know, thinking about the tools of the sort of previous generation, a lot of what we had were alternatives that compiled down to the target. So, mm-hmm. you know, we had Sass, we had Stylus, we had Less. Just like in the JavaScript world, we had like CoffeeScript and like, you know, PureScript and a bunch of other options that compiled into JavaScript. So it is interesting to see that over time, we've leaned more and more into like these compilers, these pluggable compilers for like integrating into the web. So
it was also another interesting small revolution there. Like all these tools like PostCSS, Babel, or like MDX rework, they was created on the idea of AST transformations. So like we have a parser which do nothing, just only a parse to the some sort of tree of objects. And so every plugin just changes this tree of objects, and then we have a special tool which will serialize it back to the string and will create a source map, you know, like fix the spaces, etc. And so like PostCSS was part of this, you know, like a revolution which was put to many people's mind. It was, you know, some strange feeling when a lot of people came to the same idea in the same moment and start to create the same tool, but for any different languages, like rework was created for the markdown, like retext was created even for text, or like HTML. So we have a, like a, right now we have a bunch of AST processing tool, and I really like this, you know. It was fun to create all of them.
Yeah, and it's fun to like learning it too. Like if you learn one, it's like you learn them all. Like they have slightly different syntaxes, but just getting the idea of like, oh, code becomes an AST, I can manipulate that AST, is so powerful.
Yep. I hope that maybe in some moment we will be, you know, use more like tools like Lisp or like Clojure script, because, you know, in the languages, the whole program is just an AST written on this program like structure. So you have the AST of your code written inside your program, and you don't need a parser to change something. It's like crazy. It's a very crazy idea.
Yeah, it's a cool idea. I think another interesting point is about how all of these tools are the same. They also have some of the same problems that we see across the board. Some of the trade-offs that we make about giving users the ability to add plugins is, you know, how do we execute all of these plugins to transform this AST performantly, which, you know, depending on how many plugins you have and like how many of these compilers that you sort of mesh together, especially when Webpack was like more heavily used, we'd see like longer and longer build times because it was like going through, you know, loading all this code, sending everything to like convert it to an AST, transforming the AST over and over and over and over again, you know, and like finally spitting something out. So definitely the space seems to be changing. There's a lot of people leaning more into like native code than sort of ever before. Have you thought much about that in terms of PostCSS? Maybe like what a modern version of PostCSS might be, look like, or what the sort of next iteration of it might be?
The important statement, just migrate to Lightning CSS. It's just better PostCSS. It's already written in Rust. It's already have a much better architecture. And Dev on top of it solved many problems which we have a part of the core which we could not, you know, fix without breaking changes. So just go to Lightning CSS. It's much better in every terms. Maybe, you know, just wait a little to create a system, like to put it inside your project if you have some, you know, complex situation. Or like maybe continue to use PostCSS as a tool for hacks and, you know, a new plugins, which will be hard to write in Rust language, but, you know, this is the way. So, but it's very important to understand that the performance, it came not from the native language. For instance, there is a very interesting project called CSS3. It was written by a Russian developer, and it was written on JavaScript. And it was about 3 or 5 times faster than PostCSS. And the reason of it was because he worked very carefully with the memory, and the garbage collector never called during the parsing, and it was extremely good in performance. And as a result, it was a very good example that optimization is not about native languages. It's not about the languages at all. It's about data structure. Oh, there is also another crazy story. Like initially, like in the moment when we wrote PostCSS, SAS was written in C++ and should be 5 or 10 times faster because it's C++. Everything is faster in C++. But the funny part that we was about 2 or 3 times faster, even the 4 in some moment, than C++ version of the SAS. The reason was that we was able to hack the compiler very quickly and to experiment with some funny parts. For instance, we separate the tokenizer and parser and do really black magic, really bad things with tokenizer, which nobody should even repeat or try to read. It's really black magic, but it increased performance dramatically. And because we put all this black magic into the small part of our tool, we were able to put it to the black box and forget about it. Yeah, we have different parsers for PostCSS. For instance, you can parse SAS code or any other way to write your CSS, for instance, CSS in JS. It could be parsed by PostCSS and apply some changes, for instance, formatting, etc. And the funny part was that when I need a tokenizer to tokenize SAS languages, it just needs a few tiny changes. I just copy-paste this black magic tokenizer and do, you know, changes in this file at patches, because tokenizer was written in so black magic way that it was impossible to, you know, do proper programming when you extend a tool to a new language, because it was written very badly. So I think use Lightning CSS, and a good example, which a good lesson, which we found when we create ecosystem of PostCSS, was that, you know, before we have a tool which had all features built in, for instance, SAS, you have only this small amount of feature and no more. Or we created PostCSS, the another way, when you have nothing in the core and everything which you want to do need to be added by a plugin. But we found that both this way are wrong. And we need, you know, a third way, in Buddhist ways of thinking. We need a way when we have a small predefined list of the plugins, which, you know, like need 90 80% of the developers. And if you don't need them, you need to disable them or enable some extra plugins. So this is like issue which we found in the ecosystem of PostCSS, but it was a moment when I don't really want to solve it. And I really like that Devot finally like took the flag of creating the best CSS processing tool, and it will be finally free from, you know, maintaining the PostCSS. Open source is not fun.
I love your take on this. Like, I definitely am in the same boat of I want to maintain less. And I just find it hilarious and awesome that, like, two of your biggest tools, you're like, please let them die. There's better things. Yeah, that's funny. We were going to ask you about Lightning CSS. It seems like a really cool tool.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so Lightning CSS came out of Parcel, right? It was Devin's, like... I remember when he was like packaging that up and like trying to name it or whatever. And it's really awesome to see it sort of grow on its own. It's a really cool project. And to the performance point earlier, this is a conversation that we've had with several people. I think we talked a lot to Jared, the Bun author, about performance. And it was a very similar sort of thing. It's like performance is sort of language agnostic. Like, you can write really unperformant code in any language, or you can write performant code in any language. It's just like, you know, there's a lot of work that's went into like V8 in particular to make it really, really fast. It's just like you have to know how to, you know, really leverage that. So that's cool.
We speak a lot about, you know, tiny optimization, like, you know, doing a for each loop, not from the zero to X, but from X to zero. You know, it's like tiny faster. But and we have a lot of conversation about stuff like this, like algorithmically performance about the algorithm. But in reality, the 90% of the performance is coming from the data structure. So I think we should talk more about data structure, because this is the key about the performance.
Yeah. And when you're a tool that's like super plugin based, like you're only as slow as your slowest plugin. Like, I was tweeting about ESLint this week, and really I was tweeting about the plugins that I was using being slow and not the tool itself. Before we move on from PostCSS, you've probably created a bunch of different plugins for PostCSS. What's some of your favorite ones, or like some of the weirdest ones that you've done?
You know, the funny part is that I created not so many plugins. I prefer mostly a plugin for another like people. Like, of course, my two favorite and plugins which I use everywhere is StyleLint, the linter for CSS, like a ESLint, but for CSS it's like really good. It's like helped me a lot of solving a small problem. Or for instance, my favorite way is, you know, to sort a properties of CSS in pre-commit hooks. Of course, not manually. I heard about the company. And like in Office, they have a list of the order of CSS properties, and your pull request will not pass if you not sort them manually in this way. You know, this is a very bad team lead in this company. Like, don't do this. But the like in general, sorting properties not by, you know, manually, but by the tool is very great thing, because it will speed up readability. And of course, readability is the most important part, because you will know when the property could be. And so like I use StyleLint for this, but also for many other properties, for many other jobs and like way to help me. And of course, another project is PostCSS preset env, the polyfills created by Antonio Laguna and Romani Menke. And this is like really great polyfill set, because they are really into understanding the polyfills, the CSS specification. Outside of like CSS working groups, maybe they are one of the best people who understand how new specifications works, because they need to create a polyfills, and it's really, you know, a hard work. So I think they should be like more presented in our community of developers. But like my favorite and a little crazy PostCSS plugin called PostCSS Easing Gradients. It's a tool, like, you know, when you create a gradient, it goes linearly. So like the speed of how you change the color, like start on some consistent level and go like on this level until it ends the final color. And unfortunately, this is not how the reality works. In our reality, we don't have, you know, a linear anything. Like any movements, of course, it has easings, you know, it starts faster from the beginning and then slows, or like it depends on the like nature of movings. So if you do animations, like Google about transition easings or like animations easings, you can always you can go to easing.net. Very good example. Like easings like increase like improve the animation a lot, but also it could improve the gradients, because even the gradients, you know, like color on your window, like when you do it, like, you know, a tiny part of putting, you know, gradient of the colors, it doesn't work linearly. It goes, you know, the in some easing ways, and it looks much more better for our eyes, because this is more natural way of like doing things. So amazing plugin, and I think it is one of the most underestimated plugin, and we definitely should have like the we should change the CSS to do the same in browsers, because this plugin was created in the plugin in the spirit of PostCSS. Because after he created this plugin, he created a draft to change the CSS specification to add this feature, because this is how PostCSS was created. It was a tool to do, you know, completely crazy stuff, understand that it's useful, and then put it to CSS.
That's super cool. I'm sure the gradients that it output were just these like blobs of giant CSS.
It's about 10 lines of, you know, manually adding stops to a gradient, but it's not so bad, but it's fun. It's fun to understand how it works and like understand the reality.
I was writing a gradient plugin for a open source tool that I lightly manage called Jim. And I found the same thing. I made a linear gradient and it looked terrible. And then I was like, okay, how can I use math to make this look better? And then I just made it a sine wave. And then like suddenly my gradient was beautiful, because the sine wave transitioned the color a lot easier. And then I tried to rotate it and my life got a lot harder.
Oh, yeah. This is why I like front-end development. Not because, you know, people pay a lot for front-end and we have a lot of jobs, but because, you know, when you're creating a front-end, you're creating things which will be visible by users. And so you need to understand the psychology, you need to understand the business, you need to understand, you know, you're touching every client of your website. Like any these small details, like change the way how people will feel and like maybe be more happy after, you know, they see like, you know, a snow animation, when you just don't put like a one sprite and do animation, but, you know, put a two different and create the parallax effect. This is, you know, a way of like how I like to be a front-end developer. Not, you know, arguing about what JavaScript framework is better.
Yeah, I've described my job a lot of the times as I put boxes on screens, and like that is truly what makes me happy, is making pretty boxes on screens with details you might not notice.
Yeah. Also, I have a, you know, a small icon of a bell in my application, and the designer at you know, like suggests to add some animation, but don't describe how it should work. And so I created a small bell model from the paper to understand how, you know, the small things in the bell will like goes. Depends on like position of the bell, because to understand the physics of the bell, like to make animation better. And you know, like it was a funnest part of my job.
Yeah, that's great. I agree. This is such a fun thing with front end, I think, is that if you do any traditional like graphics development, it's hard. It's hard to get into, it's hard to be proficient at, right? And you know, sometimes I feel like, you know, I definitely feel like the web wasn't made initially for the things that we use it for, but it is like approachable enough that we can do so much with it. So it's like somebody can like write some HTML, you know, they can learn that in a few days and write like some basic HTML and build like a really basic website. And then you have this like sort of master curve where you can like build this really, really compelling experience over time. And that is nice.
Yeah, this is another thing which I like from front end, that, you know, we use it right now to create most of our application, which we use every day. But it was not created to do this. It was created to create, you know, a scientific paper, which you like share between your colleagues in university. And it shows that front-end is wild. It was not created, you know, like by some idea, by some plan. It was created by, you know, the spirit of evolution, which, you know, changes the way every time something goes to another way. And so I like the spirit of front-end architecture.
And PostCSS echoes that. It started out as one thing and ended up into another. Yeah.
It was created to boost the evolution of CSS. At that moment, it was not evolving so fast. Right now, I don't have any complaints. Like right now, CSS changed so dramatically that maybe a lot of developers, front-end developers, don't understand that modern CSS is completely different from CSS 5 years ago. So right now we don't have any complaints, but at the moment when CSS, when post-CSS was created, CSS was on some sort of freezing stage and nothing changes there. And so like it was created to boost evolution, you know, like.
Mm-hmm. And that's happened. Like we have container queries now, we have grid, we have subgrid, we have OKCLH, we have all these like crazy new things.
Yep.
So recently you've done a lot of work around the new color standard OKLCH. Can you describe to our audience what that is and why you might want to use it?
Yep. So to understand why you need to use it and why and how it works, we need to understand what was changed. So right now we have two big changes in our designs. The first one is that right now we don't yet click. We have so many applications which have so many screens that we can do like manually every design of every page, you know, choosing colors by eye, by hand. And right now we have a design system and design palettes where we must to describe a system behind the colors. And it's really important in developing because it could speed up a design process like dramatically. Speed up a process of design, but also reduce the conflicts between designers. Because you know, if you choose the colors by your eye, like every designers have a different vision, and you will have a conflicts. But if you have a mass behind all colors, or maybe you know, choose a one or like three colors and create the whole palette according to mass based on these accent colors, it like will be faster and reduce the conflicts. But here a problem: we need a good mass to do a colors. And you know, colors, like they are very tricky things. Initially, you think that this is, like, colors are similar to date formats or time formats. You think that this is very simple thing. You know, just put hours and minutes into your database and it will work. But then you find that like it will not work. The system is very complex. And as a result, if you need some way to mathematically create your palette, we need a very advanced mathematic which will work. Unfortunately, HSL, RGB, it doesn't work at all. You cannot create a palette based on HSL. You will create a very big problem in accessibility at least. So please don't use HSL color model to do color transformation because it should not be used in this way. And OKLCH is the format which was created to be, you know, to have expected results. If you change, for instance, a hue, you will change only a hue. In HSL, for comparison, if you change a hue, you will change lightness as well. So this is how, unfortunately, it works. So the first reason why we need OKLCH or maybe a lab, if you know LCH, like based on lab, is because it allows you to create a whole palette according to mass. And right now, you can do it even in CSS. Because in new CSS, we will have a way to change colors a little by a math. And so you can do a really crazy stuff. You know, for instance, you can define that the way how buttons works is that if you put a mouse on top of the button and create a hover color, the current color of button will increase lightness by 10%. And you can define this math in CSS. And then you can rescheme your color to any colors, to red, to green, to blue. And this hover color will calculate automatically inside your CSS. And like this is a really cool thing. But we also have another problem. Like I told that the colors are very strange things. And we, like as a developers, don't understand how complex they are. And to be honest, we should go a little deeper into the colors because like we're creating interface. Like technically our job is to put colors to your pixels. So this is why colors is like essential sense of your work. But the funny part of the colors, which maybe a lot of people don't understand, that our screens cannot render all colors which we can see in our world. For instance, maybe like many of you like have this experience of you making a photo of a sunset, and then you like show this picture to your wife on your screen, and she doesn't understand why you're so passionate about the sunset. It's just, you know, a standard photo of like not creating any feelings. And one of the reasons why it works, because our screens can render this red, which you saw on the beach. And unfortunately, it goes from the like physics of our screens, from the pixels. Like we have a green, red, and blue pixels, and we like we can't render more saturated color that our pixels produce. So like for instance, our pixels produce, I don't know, only 50% saturation of the red, and by mixing any colors, we cannot create a 60% of the saturation. But any screens is different, but people create some sort of standard of what colors our screens will be able to produce, and this standard was created in the 90s. It's called sRGB. But recently we have a big new scientific research in the physics of producing the colors, and we created OLED screens and many other technologies which could produce much more saturated colors. But the funny part, our CSS is limited to sRGB space. And so our screens right now can render 25% more colors. Back, talking about the numbers, our screens right now, sRGB, the standard colors, is only 36% of the colors which could be visible by our eyes. So only a third of the colors could be rendered out on our screens. Right now we have like HDR colors, P3 colors. It's about 25% more. It's about a half of the colors visible by human eyes, but we can't use it in our CSS. And you know, it's, to be honest, these new colors is some sort of new retina. You can create completely new landing pages. Or, for instance, by these new colors, you will be more free of creating a design system because you will have more options to choose. And here's a problem. Hex, RGB, HSL, all these formats are not suitable to create these HDR colors. And we have a new format, and OKLCH in one of the formats which could be used to create HDR colors. So this is the reasons why OKLCH is a great thing. But also there is a third and my favorite one. It will force you to speak with your designer on, you know, on the language of colors, and you know, it will be very fun. You will be more together, and you will create a much better product because you will not, you know, this is not my job, you know, this is your job stuff. By going to the OKLCH world and then presenting this amazing thing to your designer, you will be, you know, able to create a connection with them.
Do you know if you guys use OKLCH on the Evil Martians homepage?
Yep, we're using it to color transformations. For instance, if you need to calculate what color you should use for text or for images, the contrast, the OKLCH is a very good format because it has a very predictable lightness component, and so the math is much more simple than in HSL.
Yeah, I can see it just by dragging the window from my external monitor to my Mac monitor. The color's just like up in brightness a little bit.
Fun thing, yep. Or for instance, Vercel website, it uses HDR colors as well, of course, by using OKLCH color format.
So OKLCH opens up 25% more color. What about the other 48%? Like once our screens in the far future are able to represent those, will OKLCH still be a color format that we can use for those new colors that don't yet exist on our screens?
As an important note, that we can use this 25% more colors only on hardware which support new colors, mm-hmm. This new physics. So, but it's all new, all Apple devices from 2016. So it's a lot of devices right now. The funny part that we're still limited. It's only half of the colors. Right now, there is another standard called REC 2020. And this is a standard mostly used by screens, a TV, and the HD content, HDR content from the Netflix, very likely that it will be rendered in a Rec 2020 on your screen, so it's even more colors. It will be about 60% colors. But right now, our physics of producing colors is limited to Rec 2020. Like, even finding a good screen for your laptop supporting 100% of Rec 2020, I think it's impossible right now, or maybe it's only one or two devices on the market. But the OKLCH, it's a very interesting, a very nice format because it's device independent. It could be used to produce any color, visible or even invisible by our, I'm not sure about, you know, totally invisible, but still, like, you can produce any visible colors by OKLCH. The only question is only about your screen. Will the screen be able to render it? And it's open, very interesting question. Like, you can do color processing in OKLCH. For instance, you can increase saturation and go beyond the possibilities of your screens. But if you deploy this website and, I don't know, 10 years later, people will open this website with a new hardware which could render it, you will have this better colors because, like, OKLCH is suitable for any devices.
Yeah, that's really cool. One of the things that I really love about design systems in general is that it does, as you were saying, it creates a communication layer between design and engineering that makes it the relationship very explicit. And colors in particular are really a big part of the story, and specifically, like, understanding color scales or understanding, one of the big things is just, like, saturation and really, really importantly, just, like, your contrast of the background and the text and everything, you know, for accessibility and all that other stuff. So this has been something over the years. It's just like designers will usually come up with color scales, and a lot of times you just get, like, a dump of, like, hex values of, like, and the steps are not clear. So just having, you know, having it very explicit what the steps are is a really, I think it's a huge improvement. And also it helps, like, developers replicate this in other projects and, like, figure out how to, yep, you know, how to make this more portable.
A design system is not a buttons in your, you know, storybook page. The design system is a system, and the best way to describe a system is the code. And so the, like, in ideal world, design system should not only be in the heads of designers, it should be inside your CSS. Like, your front-end code should share the same system which was created by designer. This is the idea of, like, having a system. And this is a way why design system is so important, because it increases the speed of communications between front-end and designer teams. Because if you have a system, as a designer, you don't need to explain every small pixel to the front-end developer. You can explain, like, you know, create a page, and front-end developers will be able to create this page because they already have the system inside their mind or inside their code.
So probably the last tool we'll have time to cover today, you're working on this project called Logix. Could you tell us a little bit more about what that project is and what your aims for that project are?
Yeah, this is a project. This is a framework of client-server communication, which use CRDT as a basement. So technically, this is a tool which will load a data from the server and allow you to change it with support of offline and conflict resolutions, automatically conflict resolution if two people working on the same document at some moment. But, you know, this is there is a lot of things which we is able to do it, and it's not an idea behind this project. And, you know, the funny part is idea. And I really like this project, working on this project, because, you know, I came to the front-end developer, I came to software developers because I think that we can change the world. I really, like, it's funny to hear that, like, software developing is out of the politics, because, you know, open source was a politics. Hacker movement was a politics. It was always a politics. And I like working on Logix right now because this is, for me, as a way to work on the politics, because all the CRDT and, like, conflict resolutions, it's part of technologies, which right now a lot of people experimenting about the idea which called locally first. Unfortunately, our, like, Silicon Valley and all our companies in software development, they create a world hostile to the users. We create a system where we don't own our data, and as a result, we have many problems with privacy and, you know, surveillance. On, for instance, you are not able to go from one social network to another if, for instance, you have some censorship there or something. It's especially very painful for me, like as a Russian citizen, because we have a censorship in Russian social media. And so we have right now a very important idea called Locally First. This is idea that creating a website, you're not creating, you know, a screen for your server database. Instead, you're creating a distributed system. Your client code is the application, is the whole product. And your servers is only a backup tools. So you are downloading all the data which you need from the servers to your client, do everything locally, and just synchronize the changes to the server. And for instance, maybe peer-to-peer if you want, but the idea that every machine is the node of your distributed systems. We can think that it's something overcomplicated, that it's very hard to develop, but in reality, it's even opposite. To be honest, the idea that our website is just, you know, a screen for our server database, it's a fake. To be honest, we're always creating a distributed system. But not accepting this idea, we're creating a very bad distributed systems. You know, all these problems with infinite loaders, all this, you know, crazy stuff of querying data and, you know, processing it. Right now, like when I press save on the form, I could have a problem, you know, like in New York, we have a not stable internet connection in subway, and our web is not created for these things. And creating a system which will work in these scenarios, it's so hard if you're not start to think that your website is just a node of distributed system. And so the good part of Locally First, it's not even harder to create the system. We just, you know, need to stop to think about big startups, Google, Facebook, and, you know, all these companies. And, you know, to going back to our origin of software development, go back to the hacker's nature and hacker spirit. And, like, Locally First community is amazing. Just go there. I really like that. They have, you know, that spirit.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this project's really so interesting because, first, local first software is hard. It's a hard problem. You know, just trying to understand like CRDTs is hard. I mean, these are intense projects, and you know, getting all the architecture together for this is a challenge. And I like this, you know, having it all packaged up into one thing. So, just briefly, what are the technology decisions that you've made for this project that you think is enabling or like makes it easier for people to get started in this space? Why should someone use it?
My favorite idea is that you have a local database, sort of database on your system. To be honest, we have it on the modern front end anyway. For instance, like if you have a Apollo client, you will have a cache. And to be honest, the cache is a database. But if you, from the beginning, will think that this is a database, it becomes much more easier. But in Logox, like there is a lot of CRDT projects which think in the way of having a local database. For instance, Firebase, it's not CRDT, but you could create a similar system or maybe many other system. But in Logox, we went a little different way. So we are thinking that you not have a database on the client, but instead you have a persistent stores on your client side. So right now we are thinking in our front-end development about, you know, component first way. So whole logic is described in our component. And as a result, it's hard to test, it's hard to migrate on other JavaScript framework. But in Logox, we switch our perspective that your logic is described in your stores, in your state managers. And so your database is your state manager. And as a result, all CRDT stuff is hidden inside stores which you use as is from the NPM packages. And as a result, like your client-side code becomes sometimes even simpler than, you know, doing a proper AJAX request. Because like everything is packed inside, is hidden inside these stores. But in contrast with database, Logos has, you know, onion structures, and you can like remove this layer of smart stores and go directly to a lock, an event source model, which connected to the WebSocket, and, you know, do another stuff around it. This is what I like, but to be honest, Logox is not the best tool. There is a plenty of them right now. And this is, I believe, the revolution of frontend is going in this place. And so, like, Logox is only my way to say something, but there is so many interesting CRDT databases right now. You know, just go there and try them. It's fun.
Yeah, that's awesome. We could probably do a whole episode on that.
Okay. That wraps it up for tooltips this week. Thanks for coming on, Andre. This was a lot of fun. You're a titan in the space, and it tickles me that you want all your tools to die. So thanks for coming on.
Thank you for inviting. You have very good questions.
Yeah. It was such a pleasure to have you on. I definitely hope that the web continues to progress in positive ways, and the tools that we made to get around the limitations of the past are no longer necessary, and we can focus on cool new things.